Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry to interrupt your lunch. We hope you're enjoying it. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with the Board of Governors here at the FCC and with Reuters. Before we get started, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. We have a very busy march of speakers, so let me tell you what's coming up in the next few sessions after we get down, before we get down to the big one today. On Thursday this week, Zhang Xin, who is the head of Soho Real Estate, will be here at lunch to give us her outlook on the Chinese real estate market. And next week, we have Lord Peter Goldsmith, QC, who will be here speaking on law, war, and terror. And later on this month, we have David Yang Zworin, who will be speaking about why China promotes Confucianism. So do mark your calendars, and we look forward to seeing you for those events as well. Now, let's get down to the event of the day, too big to fail. We were sitting at lunch trying to remember where we were in the autumn of 2008. Do you remember where you were? Well, Michelle Davis, who's our speaker today, definitely remembers where she was, which was right in the middle of the storm in the Treasury. She was special advisor to the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson at the time. She's now a partner with Brunswick Group in Washington, and she's passing through the region, but will tell us today what it was like to be at the center of the storm. Michelle?
Well, thank you all for coming. As you might imagine, it was a crazy 2008, and I could probably talk for far too long about all of the what it was like. So I will try to be brief and leave some time for questions, so I make sure we cover the things you're interested in. Where to begin? It all started where most of you probably reported and know it all started. For years and years and years, the U.S. government had a fragmented financial regulatory system, had policies that encouraged and subsidized home ownership, and then we had low interest rates for a good period, and the three of those things together were kind of the classic ingredients for a bubble. I certainly didn't see it coming. In 2006, when Hank Paulson decided to come down and be Treasury Secretary, I actually said to him, "Why are you doing this? There's nothing to do. It's the end of an administration. What do you think you can accomplish as Treasury Secretary the last 2 years?" Little did I know there'd be plenty to do. I guess by 2007, we sort of saw housing bubble bursting in different parts of the country, and foreclosures starting to mount, and had plenty of things to do on our hands to figure out what was going on. The crunch time began when Bear Stearns failed in March of 2008. That certainly got everyone's attention, and we began working on emergency plans. What will we do if this gets a heck of a lot worse? Treasury folks and people from the Fed and the other regulatory bodies sitting around creating all kinds of options and trying to think through what could go wrong and what could the government do? And we had what became to be called the break the glass plan. It was, you've all seen those boxes on the wall that say, in case of emergency, break the glass. And there's usually a hatchet or something in there that we didn't need a hatchet. But we spent most of that summer trying to think through any kind of systemic answer to what was happening. And meanwhile, we just watching things get worse and worse. To me, the thing that we spent an enormous amount of time on, and I think that often doesn't get as much attention because it was putting the two GSEs into conservatorship when we put Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into government control to prevent their failure. They had something like $5 trillion in debt outstanding, lots of it held over here. The ripple effect of any kind of a default by either one of those two was, completely unimaginable. And we spent most of the month of August just in rooms pouring through how to keep those two organizations from failing. And really, difficult sessions with Hank and with Ben Bernanke having to meet with their boards and explain what was happening. And I think we felt like that at the end of August, the beginning of September, when we put those two into conservatorship, we thought, okay, big sigh of relief. You know, this $5 trillion in outstanding debt is now backed by the U.S. government. This, you know, we should be able to breathe a little easier. No such thing as breathing easier. Then, you know, next morning, instead of waking up to breathe easily, it was immediately apparent that Lehman Brothers was teetering on the edge. And this became sort of the cycle of the fall, was every time you'd solve one problem, you'd get about 2 seconds to think that you made some progress until the next awful thing would pop up. We were watching it became a serious, almost like a domino effect of bank failures of, when, you know, Countrywide, Washington Mutual, big mortgage holders, just one after another. Every Sunday night, we would have to have some sort of a rescue mission. It became the busiest day of our week. And for the media, for all of us, the most frustrating part of the week, every weekend was when we would make all of our news, because it would, you know, we'd get some bank to limp along till Friday so that we could then, you know, sell it to somebody over the weekend. It was not the normal way you go through any sort of the typical M&A process is a little longer than that. There were definitely moments along the way that were just hard to believe. I think when we finally went through that weekend of the Lehman Brothers failure, you know, the challenge through all of this was to try to explain to people what could government do? What powers does the government have here? And we did not have, there was no authority anywhere in the government that would have let us go in and prop up Lehman Brothers on its own. When Bear Stearns had failed in March, the government didn't go in and buy it. J.P. Morgan bought it, and the government helped through the Fed to sort of, you know, facilitate that sale. That was legal. There was nothing in the law that said that the government could do anything on its own. And yet, you try to, you know, if we went out and said that really strongly, which just scared the heck out of people, right? I mean, everyone's looking to the U.S. government for solutions. So we're sitting in meetings all the time, every day of that week before Lehman failed. What can we do? You know, what can we do with, you know, what about Bank of America? What about, you know, we're calling banks all over the world. What about Barclays? You know, what, well, can someone come in? Can we get somebody to buy this thing? And you know, all the journalists calling, but you know, but the government is going to fix this, right? And you know, if you say no, we can't. Boy, panic would really ensue. So we really had to walk quite a tightrope of trying everything we possibly could, go into that weekend. And of course, Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch that weekend. And I remember, you know, Hank was somewhere in the meetings and called me to say, you know, just talk to John Thayne, and this looks like it's going to be Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. And, you know, it's like, what are we going to do with Lehman Brothers? You know, desperately trying to find something that would work with Barclays Bank to just keep Lehman from failing. And despite every single attempt at everything, by Sunday night, it was clear there wasn't going to be any rescue. And felt like, you know, it was a horrible feeling, knowing that you'd tried everything you possibly could and nothing was going to work. And then, so, it, you know, announced the, they filed for bankruptcy, and it was all announced. And the first thing you saw that Monday morning was the U.S. markets actually going up. And we all looked at each other like, what planet are we, what is this? How can this be happening? Of course, it didn't take long for that to turn around. But it was sort of a shocking, it tells you something about, there was a lot of people out there who thought that a failure was a good thing. The whole moral hazard argument that we can't have the government constantly, businesses can't take the upside and not the downside. Of course, but once it became clear, all the interconnectedness, that sentiment quickly turned around, and that week was pretty awful. You know, so we get through that, and then I think the lowest point, I was saying this, the biggest surprise and the lowest point of that entire process was to live through that day, that Monday, and Lehman Brothers failing and everybody blaming the government for not figuring out a way to prop it up. And then we get a call to and find out that AIG is on the verge of bankruptcy. But that was on nobody's radar screen, not regulated by the federal government at all. Bunch of state-regulated insurance companies. And then to find out that there were, you know, within days, they were going to not be able to meet their obligations too. You know, you just go into a whole other mode of, okay, let's scour the government, let's scour all the laws we have, what can we do? Thank goodness it was a different situation, and because it was an insurance company with longer-term assets, the Fed could lend money to them and they could survive. But that really was when we realized, you know, this one-off, one rescue after another thing is just not working. We need to go to the Congress and get the Congress to pass some legislation so we can create some confidence underlying the system and really put a systemic solution into place. Of course, that's easier said than done because it was 6 weeks before a presidential election, or 8 weeks before a presidential election. And the last thing on earth anybody, Republican or Democrat, wanted to do was vote to put $700 billion into a bunch of banks. That doesn't really win you a lot of votes around the country. I think it's hard. I've found as I talk to people who aren't outside of the U.S., it's hard to convey how strongly the U.S. public rejects the notion of government ownership of any kind of a company, especially a bank. I think in a lot of other countries it's okay, it's not great, but it happens once in a while. This was just completely unprecedented for the government to own any sort of major business in the U.S. and to come in and just take over. And we would have moments where we would sit there and think, I can't believe we're doing this, but you know, what else were we going to do? The plan we went up to the Congress with, when I went up there with Hank and Chairman Bernanke, they had to testify. Big giant congressional hearing room. I walk in and Chairman Bernanke was already there and my counterpart from the Fed was already sitting there and had a seat next to me for her. And I walk in and the first thing she says to me as I sit down is, don't look behind you, but the guy behind us has a gas mask in his lap. I'm like, oh boy, this is not going to be your typical congressional testimony, I can tell. You know, protesters all over the place, things that, you know, and a public interest in topics that until then, you could barely, you know, barely the Wall Street Journal would put in page B12, you know, about who you're trying to suddenly explain to the world what a credit default swap is and what option adjusted spreads are and why they matter and why, what, you know, and all these things that nobody ever paid attention to. And trying to convey to the public, the US economy at this point is still chugging along just fine. You know, we've seen credit freezing in the financial system, but it hasn't yet translated to, you know, companies not being able to get loans to expand or people not being able to get a new car loan. You know, it hadn't quite hit the consumers yet. And trying to explain to people that we were trying to take preemptive action because, you know, if this credit squeeze went on for too long, Hank and everybody was predicting, you know, it could be, you know, 25% unemployment. Chairman Bernanke even said, we're going to see the repeat of the Great Depression. But because people weren't seeing it yet, they completely resented it and refused to go along. Banks are struggling, the financial system's struggling, and we finally get to a vote in the Congress. And I had worked in the House of Representatives for 6 years for the majority leader who ran the floor and made all the legislation go through tried to make the process as smooth as possible. So we finally get to a vote in the House for this bill, and Speaker Pelosi called the bill up for a vote. And you know, again, being completely having no foresight whatsoever, I said, well, this is good. She called it up for a vote. There must be enough votes to pass this, because otherwise she would, we wouldn't be having a vote on this. Vote opens. We're watching C-SPAN at home. I was in Hank's office with him watching C-SPAN. And the votes, you know, the votes are going up, and you need to get to 218 to get a majority. And it's 202, 203. It's like slowly creeping up, and there's a whole handful of people that haven't voted yet. And it just stops, and like everything just freezes, and like you can tell, you know, that somewhere in the back of the room, they're back there twisting arms, trying to get those last six or seven votes, and it's just not happening. And just that was the longest 20 minutes of the whole fall, because just staring at this TV screen, watching numbers that aren't changing, and knowing what rests in the balance, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the no's piled on, and the bill failed, and That was probably another enormous low in the process. Like, wow, we did everything we could to get some powers to be able to fix this process, and the Congress just said no. They all went and did press conferences, quite proud of themselves that they had voted down this big government bailout, and then they watched the stock market drop about 700 points, and decided that maybe they shouldn't have done that. So. But you know, we went over to the White House and had a meeting with the president. As soon as the vote was over, I was like, okay, now what? You know, and everybody sort of, everyone was very down. I mean, all of us from Treasury, the Fed chairman and his staff were just very like, we don't know what else to do. And I will say, President Bush was at his best that day, because he normally would come into a meeting and you'd kind of tell him what was going on, and he'd tell you what he thought, and he'd make a couple of decisions, and he'd go on to do his next thing. Meeting ended, and he spent the next 10 minutes just walking around the room, like patting people on the shoulder, you know, we're going to get there, so we're going to get through this. The market drop did help with that. It obviously got their attention, and a couple days later, we did get the legislation passed, but it was a pretty trying circumstance. Then we went right from there to, we were going to buy mortgages. That was the plan, was to buy a lot of these toxic mortgages that couldn't be traded, couldn't be valued. If we could get those off of bank balance sheets, banks could go back to doing what they were supposed to be doing. Very good plan in theory. In reality, would take months and months and months to build it up and put it into place. So we didn't have that kind of time and needed to inject some confidence right away into the banks. Into the financial system broadly, and basically the only way to do that was to force some of these, or couldn't force, but to strongly encourage a lot of the banks to just take preferred stock, take capital from the U.S. government. If at the time the London and the U.K. government was doing something similar, and they had put very stringent conditions on the capital that they were giving, and as a result, the banks that were in really bad shape took it because they had to, others didn't. And it was immediately obvious to the world who were the strong banks and who were the weak banks in the UK. We didn't want to go down that road. We wanted to get as much capital into the banking system as fast as possible, without any judgment on the banks themselves, just mostly seeing them as conduits to getting this money in and boosting the confidence in the system. So. Called in the largest banks in the country and two Bank of New York and State Street that were just critical infrastructure banks, and sat them all down across the table. You had all the bank CEOs on one side of the table. You had Hank and Chairman Bernanke and Tim Geithner and Sheila Bair, the regulators on the other side, and just said, look, here's what we need you to do. No judgment on you whether you need this or not. But the country needs you, the banking system needs you to take this capital as a vote of to get some confidence into the system. A few in the room were not so happy with that idea. I guess it's probably already been said before. So Wells Fargo was very much, why should we take this? Why should we take this money? I'm not gonna, we don't need this. Hank basically turned to them all and said, you can walk away, I can't make you do this, but don't turn back to me. Don't come back to me in the coming weeks or months and tell me you suddenly need some help, because this is I will not be there for you. And I think all of them kind of saw it as, okay, we're on the edge of a precipice here. We don't know what's happening, so we better all jump on board. And it was amazing to watch. It was, all the Wall Street CEOs basically signing up for what did immediately put a stop to the free fall in the markets. It certainly wasn't over that day. It's still not over, I don't think. But that was a real turning point in the in stabilizing the system. I could go on and on, but I'm sure you probably that's enough probably blow by blow. We had lots of further. You know, we still had to again in November revisit cities. Condition and take some additional steps there. Even as it was the end, you know, the administration was winding down, the election was over. We were meeting with the Obama transition teams and trying. And thank goodness, Tim Geithner was going to be Secretary of Treasury, so there'd be some continuity. I would watch my colleagues at the White House and at every other agency doing what normally happens in a transition. People are leaving, people are out job hunting. You know, by Christmas, most of the offices are relatively empty because people have to move on with their life. And we're at Treasury just plugging away. You know, there's still all kinds of things that need to happen. So Inauguration Day is January 20th, and the day before, on a Sunday, we're all in the office still. They had wanted us to turn our BlackBerries in on Friday because it was like, oh, you know, it's a holiday weekend. You won't need those anymore. And we're basically planning another government investment in Bank of America. I'm like, okay, so I think I'm going to need my BlackBerry for this. And they're setting up tables in the hallway. The inaugural parade route is right past the Treasury building. So the facility staff is out in the hallway setting up big tables and putting out white tablecloths because all the staff want to come in and bring their families to watch the parade. And we're in the next room having this conference call about the next piece of the Bank of America rescue. So we had to hand over to the next administration at noon on that day, on January 20th. And I think we worked up till like 11:59. And I remember thinking, who's going to suddenly explain all of this stuff, you know, in an hour? It was really difficult timing. I mean, not just the difficulty of the whole situation in the markets, but the political side of it too, and the transition and all of those pieces just even made it more crazy. And like I said, I think we're still recovering from it. I mean, housing is still not rebounded in the U.S. There's still big pockets of the country that are where most homes are underwater. Jobs you're starting to see come back, but it's been slow. And the financial sector regulation is years behind. I mean, we finally passed legislation to redo the oversight of the financial system in the U.S., and they're nowhere near done. And they haven't touched what was one of the big roots of the problem, which is just the U.S. government's policies to stimulate home ownership. Those are all still there. So there's a whole lot of work left to be done. And to be quite honest, I'm glad I'm not still there sitting there trying to figure it out.
Why don't we open it up to questions? I'm sure there's quite a few on the back of that. Michelle, thank you very, very much. Questions from the floor. We have a microphone, so if you raise your hand and tell us your name and where you're from. Who wants to start off? Mm-hmm. Doug.
Sorry, I'm going to abuse the fact that I've already got a microphone here. Douglas Wong from the board as well. Michelle, what was your advice to your successor, Tim Geithner's advisor? Did it come in the form of a letter, or is that only for presidents?
he didn't have one right away. I mean, that's the U.S. the U.S. system. It takes a while. I mean, on Inauguration Day, they put in place most of the cabinet secretaries. And that's about all. I mean, my position was a Senate-confirmed position, so you have to go through the nomination process and a hearing. And so, he had someone who was there as an advisor and who could sort of leap in. But she, as is also normal with a new administration, the White House wants to control what's going on in all the departments at the beginning. I mean, that's true of every administration. And in this case, the person they had put at Treasury had been on the campaign and was very politically savvy, but didn't know this material at all. So there was a lot of catching up to do. We all tried to make it as smooth a transition as possible. Several people did stay, which is almost unheard of in a change of administrations from one party to another. But four of our senior advisors on the policy side did stay for several months. to try to smooth the transition. And I went over there every couple of days, and was on the phone every couple of days with the new people, just to try to help help with that transition. But the election being in November and then the swearing in not till January 20th, that is way too long. 10 weeks of who's really in charge here, and well, we're not in charge anymore, but I guess we technically are, and should we include the new guys before we make this decision? It way too long.
David.
Thanks. David Schlesinger, Thompson Reuters. Could you just sum up your proudest moment and the biggest miss during the period?
Oh, boy. God, that's hard. The biggest miss, I guess, the one thing that it's probably very inside baseball, but the one thing that we did that we should have done better, when we finally did go up to Congress and ask them for legislation, we thought we were doing the right thing by just walking up there with a short outline of the bill, because we wanted to not sound like, you know, we were being obnoxious and saying, here, pass this. And it was, of course, immediately reported as how, you know, all the congressmen went, how can you just come up here with a 3-page outline? This is, you know, this, and I feel like, I mean, I guess I always feel like I should have recognized that as, you know, they were going to panic. And it just made us all look less thoughtful and less organized than we were going into a big legislative debate. Sorry. There are probably a million little tactical things that, you know, wish we could have done differently. I don't know that how anyone can have a proudest moment through all of that stuff. Getting through it, I guess. That's a really tough one. I'll have to think about that and get back to you.
Jane.
Yes, Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. You had mentioned that the root of the problem that brought down this system was the U.S. government's policy to stimulate home ownership. And that's sort of been an ongoing policy for a long time, not only through subprime, but also the fact that interest on mortgages for a primary resident are tax deductible, mm-hmm. and so forth. And a lot of that, I believe, is to prop up the or support the building trades, the whole construction industry, right, which is a leading indicator. So if that was the root of the problem and you take that away, what impact do you feel that would have on the U.S. economy?
Right, that's exactly the nub of the issue, that you can't, that's probably why nothing's happened in that arena, because the economy's not strong enough yet. But, I don't think it's the only cause. I mean, I think it was a big factor. You know, it was one thing. It became assumed that once you had a mortgage on a house, of course, you know, that was a safe. People were going to do anything they could to keep their paying their mortgage because they didn't want to lose their house, and that was probably true when people had to put 20% down payments in there, and you had a lot of that was your nest egg, that was your biggest source of wealth. But then once people were just paying a mortgage payment the same way you'd pay a rent and had no equity in the house, that behavioral shift was something that nobody factored in, that would change the way people thought about their mortgages. And so part of what they're doing is you can't get a loan anymore that's, you know, no money down. I mean, so they're trying to recognize those, and that people have to have equity in order to treat their home as something different than a typical investment or a typical loan. Yeah, that those underlying policies, whether it's the GSEs or FHA, we have a whole department in the government, housing, Department of Urban Development, that is all about providing support to home ownership. And the tax deductions, none of those are going to go away overnight, because the vast majority of Americans, that is where their wealth is, it's in their home. And so, you know, if you've already knocked down housing values because this bubble burst, you can't then have policy changes that further undermine the value of housing. I mean, that's not going to help right now. You know, politicians talk all the time about tax reform, and maybe they'll eventually do something about that tax deduction for home interest. Probably not anytime soon. That's going to be a longer debate and a much more difficult one politically. There's no upside politically to take some of those benefits away. And we all know that that makes it almost impossible to get it done.
Over here.
Christian Schubert with BASF. It probably a very naive question, and please, I apologize if it is, but was there ever any discussion rather than bailing out the banks to bail out the homeowners, following up on the question before?
Yeah, I think, you know, we certainly talked about it, and this administration has talked about it. It's really hard. I think that's one area where when the new administration came in, they constantly pointed to that as something that we had not done, that they were going to do, and they haven't been able to figure it out either. It's really difficult because these mortgages were sliced and diced and packaged off to somebody else, and nobody even knows who owns their mortgage. You don't even know who to go negotiate with. I mean, it's taken years to just find the right way to, you know, I mean, the idea of a bank, the person you're writing your mortgage check to is rarely the company that owns your mortgage. And so they don't have the authority to knock down the principal on your loan because your loan is part of some big mortgage-backed security owned by 100 different investors around the world. And you have to get their permission to knock down the principal value of the loan. So it's just, it got so messy and complicated, and the record keeping was so bad throughout the whole process that it's proven to be much more difficult and complicated. I think, you know, that question is certainly what almost all Americans want to know too. I mean, it's like, why would you save a bank and not save my neighbor who just lost his house? And it's really hard to make the connection. But it just, I mean, there are lawsuits all over the U.S. these days about who had the rights to change this mortgage, this thing, this feature in a mortgage, and that part of a mortgage. And it's gotten so mired in lawsuits that it's been really difficult to help people. We pulled together a whole bunch of nonprofits that did homeownership counseling and tried and connected them to the banks, and the banks didn't even have large departments of people to help work out your mortgage because there'd been no demand for that, right? So all the people, they just didn't have to have a lot of people in that department because people weren't struggling to pay. So they beefed up all of the, you know, they had to beef up those departments and try to streamline things. And then you had all this massive consolidation, right? So you see, you know, Bank of America with all of a sudden is responsible for Countrywide's mortgages. Well, that's a whole different system that they just bought, but they don't know how it works, you know, and it's like all of this integration parts of it that made it more complicated, and it still is. I mean, it's something President Obama, I think last week, made another announcement of some small program to try to help homeowners. And there are little steps that can be taken, and they're trying to uncover those, but there's just is not a magic bullet on that because of the way the mortgages are securitized.
In the back here, and then we'll come here.
Hi, Graham Ernst. I live here in Hong Kong. Just as a follow-up to that, why do you have to reduce the principal? If the mortgages have been sliced off and you don't know who has it, why not just give the money directly to the homeowner rather than reducing the value of the mortgage?
Congress could do anything, I guess. I mean, that's something they could do. I guess you'd have to figure out who gets it and who doesn't. And, you know, I think there's also a sense of fairness at play here politically among...
But through the TARP, you had a fair amount of discretionary authority on what you could have done with the $700 billion, right? I mean, you thought at one point, hey, we're going to go buy assets. A couple weeks later, we're going to go give warrants in banks. Why not? Did you have the discretion to give the money directly to the homeowners?
I'll say when we, in the fall of 2008, what we were looking for was how to get the biggest bang for the buck at quickly to stabilize the system. So we did not, I mean, the reason we didn't buy mortgages was the whole, you know, how do we, by the time we set up something like that and figured out how to make it work and administer it, it would take too long. And I think anything that involved individuals, same way. I mean, the Treasury Department is one of the smallest departments in the government. There's no infrastructure for working directly with people.
The IRS has a relationship with every individual.
and by law, there's a, it's all.
I mean,
for administrative purposes, they are, but they're, by law, it's, there's a big giant firewall there. I mean, all of these things are things that, that you know, make sense if you don't run into all the normal, all these obstacles. I don't know why. I mean, I think this, the, after we were gone, when there was more time to think about homeownership, I mean, these, the homeowners that are underwater, I don't know if they've talked, they ever talked about some kind of a direct payment to the homeowners who are underwater. But politically, I will say, while nobody, people are, don't like their housing value going down, they don't like that, you know, there's foreclosures in their neighborhood and that means their own property value is dropping, they also really resent the people who got themselves in trouble getting a handout. And so I think there's a political issue there that this administration for 3 years now has tried to navigate, that, you know, why should somebody who got a mortgage and paid it on time and played by the rules not get the benefit of a handout directly to somebody who, you know, didn't do their own due diligence to figure out whether or not they could handle a mortgage? And it's, that's a tough political navigation.
We have time for one more question here. Right here in the front.
Yep. Hi, Vishal Malwani at Eversheds here. I'm wondering, a lot of people are saying that a private sector debt crisis has been turned into a public sector debt crisis. And I was wondering if you could comment on what the feelings were at the time. Did you think of this as a crisis measure which would sort of be stopped, or did you foresee that this quantitative easing might go on for a long, long time?
Well, that, the Fed is independent, and we were not, and we were never really part of those, the actual monetary policy decisions. So we worked really closely together on a lot of other things, but not that. I think at least in the fall of 2008, I think everyone knew this was gonna be a big enough impact. What was happening was really bad, and that it was not gonna be something that ended overnight. I don't think anybody predicted, could really with any have any kind of correct foresight into how long things would last. We certainly, when we put the GSEs into conservatorship, you know, I mean, that was something that we wanted to make, that was supposed to be temporary, and they're still there. That's one of the things that we look back on. I mean, all of my former colleagues, we all look back on that and like, there must have been something we could have done so that this wasn't permanent conservatorship, because that's terrible. A lot of things that were done in that 3 month period were, we knew they had longer term consequences, but we were so worried about the short term that we were willing to take that chance. And I think, you know, I can't speak for the Fed, but I'm, you know, that I think things were so dire. And now it's a slow process of working our way out of it.
It's 2:00, so we're going to leave it there so everyone can get back to their offices. Michelle, thanks very much for your time today. And
thanks
on behalf of the club, we have a small gift for you, hand to you. And have a good afternoon, everybody.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Yeah.